Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Thursday, September 17th. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News. I'm joined in the studio, as always, by Christopher C. Dub Wynn. He's the deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, C. Wagner.
Also joining us, as always, is Lauren Smart, the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. Hello, Lauren.
Hello, Chris.
On today's show, we'll talk with Dallas Morning News staff writer Avi Selk about his story that broke the internet this week involving a Muslim boy, a homemade clock, and handcuffs. Next, we'll journey into Dallas's underground world of lucha libre. Did I say that right?
Nice.
Lucha libre. Thank you. The masked and costume Mexican wrestling sport. Aldea writer Viene Aldretti. Did I say that right? Awesome. I'm on a roll. And Dallas Morning News photographer Nathan Hunsinger talk about what they saw. Aldea's unique cross-departmental piece of journalism will also be a focus of this segment. Finally, have we got friends in low places? Yes, and his name is Hunter Hawk. I always knew there was something shady about that guy. DMN's pop music critic joins us to explain why Dallas is still obsessed enough with Garth Brooks that the country crooner was able to sell out 7 shows this week, which is kind of insane.
Kind of amazing, yeah.
But first, it's good to be back in the USA.
We're glad to have you back after your international travels.
You.
It was very international, and I'm now very stuffed up from all the hotels and the airplanes. But Venice was nice.
Best food you ate while you were there?
Pizza, like nonstop.
Yeah, okay.
Like all the time. It's so good. I would just eat like I would make a meal of the pizza crust if I could.
Mm. Seriously?
In Venice.
That's good.
Yeah.
Oh, I want that right now.
It's so good. I mean, the rest of the pizza is good.
I saw you were stalking Jake Gyllenhaal.
He was stalking me, actually.
Awkward.
No, he was just right there. I mean, that's one of the cool things about that festival. It's just very intimate, and people are just kind of walking around. He was just chilling in the lobby of this movie palace talking to some friends. So I snapped
He wasn't getting mobbed by
he wasn't,
young
actually.
Women?
He wasn't. I mean, I'm sure if they saw him, he would have been. But yeah, me and Jake. Actually, I saw 2 Jake Gyllenhaal movies during my travels. I saw Everest.
Oh, that's right.
Which was at opened Venice, and then Demolition, which opened Toronto. Wow, it just occurred to me he opened.
Wow, good for Jake Gyllenhaal.
Both festivals.
So you really were kind of stalking him.
Yeah,
kind of was across
creepy
across all around the world.
Across
hey,
continents.
Jake. Yeah, I'm back, man.
What flight is he on? Hello, Jake. How are you? Why don't we get started with the show? It's Monday of this week. 14-year-old Ahmed Mohammed, who attends MacArthur High School in Irving, was arrested for bringing a bomb to school. Only it was actually just a clock. Sometimes a clock is merely a clock. Dallas Morning News staff writer Avi Selk broke the story, which in turn broke the internet. Now Ahmed has gone from handcuffed to hero overnight with accolades from the likes of President Obama and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. Sorry, Mark. Avi joins us today to talk about what happened, what it says about all of us, and what some are calling America's Islamophobia problem. Avi, thanks for fitting us into your schedule between MSNBC and BBC and all those important people.
Happy to do it.
Awesome. Well, just give us a little nuts and bolts that I didn't just say. How did this start? How did this come about?
Sure. This is a kid who just got out of middle school. He's in his first weeks of high school. He's a tinkerer. He wants to be an engineer. He was in robotics club in middle school, and he's looking to find kind of a similar niche in high school. And so he, figures the best way to do it is he's going to rig a little something together, show his teachers a little electronic thingy. And, he was very clear that this clock he made wasn't even anything he was really impressed by. He said he rigged it up in about 20 minutes, before bed. It's a circuit board, a digital sort of clock display, basically strapped inside a little case. And he takes it to school and shows it to his engineering teacher. Engineering teacher says, that's a cool homemade clock. Maybe be a little careful about who you show that to, because it does look a little weird. So Ahmed puts it inside his school bag. He's in English class. Apparently the clock kind of like beeps in the middle of English class. The teacher is like, who's beeping? Stop it. Right. After class, Ahmed brings it up there. He says, sure, I made a little clock. According to Ahmed, teacher says, that looks like a bomb to me. And the boy says, it doesn't look like a bomb to me. It looks like a clock. And the teacher says, well, maybe I'll just hold on to that. A couple more classes go by. It's afternoon, nearly out of school, and principal and police officer walk in, fetch Ahmed out of his avid class and take him to a room where there's 4 other police officers and his clock. And he is essentially, I don't know if the official word is interrogated, but that's what it felt like to him, as the officers basically questioned what he had made. And the significant thing is, you know, when I followed up with a police spokesman later, they don't differ at all from Ahmed's version of the story. He told them it was a clock. And the police obviously didn't think it was dangerous, or they would have evacuated the school. But they did say that Ahmed was being a little kind of surly and or passive-aggressive and not really elaborating beyond the fact that it's a clock. And, you know, Ahmed doesn't feel that there was much to elaborate on besides the fact that it was a clock. But the police ended up arresting him and charging him with making a hoax bomb, which is an actual misdemeanor crime. They didn't put him inside a cell or anything. They did fingerprint him, released him to his family. And then, you know, a day later, after he became President Obama and the entire world, they announced that he would not face any charges, though he has been home from school since then.
That's probably a good call once the president shows that he is against what you're doing to reverse right. course a little bit.
So, like, just to be clear, at no point did he say, oh, I made a hoax. At every point, he said, oh, this is a clock.
At every point, he said, this is a clock. He never said it was anything dangerous.
That's where I got confused about reading the early reports, is that, you know, was he being evasive? You know, were they reading into it? Or was he just a kid who's being cornered and questioned and, yeah, a little ticked off about it?
A little ticked off.
No pun intended. Yeah.
And I guess that's where, you know, his feeling and his family's feeling and apparently millions of people's feeling that essentially this happened because he's very obviously Muslim. You know, he has like the Joe Smith of Muslim names, you know, Ahmed Muhammad. And, you know, brown skin. And so he feels, especially because Irving had, you know, it's had some sort of issues with claims of Islamophobia, you know, among certain elected officials. A lot of people think that that's behind this, although the police are very, very clear that they deny that, you know, and there's no evidence that the police took into account his religion when they arrested him. But it is something he feels very strongly happened.
Well, it certainly seems that would be why the entire country, the entire world is paying so much attention to that, is that maybe that is something we don't acknowledge on a regular basis, that, you know, 14-year-old Lauren in Plano isn't going to get arrested for bringing a fake clock to school, mm-hmm. a clock that I might have made for an engineering class. But if you are the kind of person they're profiling at TSA or in situations like that, then you're much more likely that would happen. I can't tell you how many times as a 14-year-old I had attitude and did things I wasn't supposed to do and probably, you know, put other people in situations that made them uncomfortable. But
did you make clocks?
But I no. Well, I wasn't that smart. I wasn't that smart.
I mean, it's true. This came up for me a couple of weeks ago. A friend of ours was over who was helping us do something, and he went into the backyard to get a tool, and he's half African-American, half Puerto Rican. And I had a neighbor actually text me and say, hey, someone's in your backyard.
Yeah.
And it just made me, you know, A, I'm glad they're being observant, but B, it's like, wow, interesting. I wonder if he looked different, if I would have received that text.
Suspicious colored man.
Right.
In Christopher's yard, check.
So the incident certainly brought all that to light and just sort of exploded. And so you're right. There's kind of the thing that happened, and then there's the reaction to what happened. So a lot of people, and this came up yesterday at our editorial meeting, we were debating it. And yes, if there's a device, you know, it was a little strange looking. I think everyone kind of agrees. But then the reaction to what they did once they had discovered it is what seems to be so heavy-handed and so overkill.
That's true. I mean, some people were blaming the English teacher who we assume, you know, either called police or had the principal do so, but. It was funny. I was talking to another MacArthur student. So what was the day after this became a huge sensation? I was like, what are kids saying about this in the class? And there's a lot of like really bright kids in Irving ISD. So his class actually managed to have like a debate about Ahmed and who was in the right and who was in the wrong. And apparently they kind of came to the conclusion that the police overreacted and that never should have happened to Ahmed. They did sort of understand why the English teacher at least, you know, took the device and passed it up the chain and kind of set these events in motion. So it's a lot of the scrutiny is falling on the police department, and it's now kind of drifting over into the, you know, city hall and, you know, the mayor and some of the council people, because there's this history in Irving, at least with Mayor Beth Van Dyne, of making what a lot of people take as anti-Islamic remarks, which she's been doing in public speeches. So that's sort of where the heat is right now. The school district may kind of slip out of it, the noose a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by the process in which a story becomes viral and what the ingredients are and what makes it spread. I mean, you've been on BBC talking about this. Mm. You just did MSNBC, is that correct?
Yeah.
So you're feeling it. You're being stretched in all these different directions, and you're the guy who wrote the story. What do you think the ingredients are in this case? Why are we so fascinated by this? I'm fascinated by it. I'm not saying I'm not. Just mm-hmm. curious what your thoughts are.
I mean, to the extent I've had time to think about it, which isn't a lot.
Right. It's been a blur for you. Yeah.
So there's two things going on. These stories of, schools overreacting and kids getting arrested for bringing harmless devices, these happen from time to time. And they become, a little bit viral. They go around, sometimes the state, sometimes the country for a little while. I don't think any of those have ever hit this kind of level where I was up, late at night doing radio interviews in New Zealand because they're fascinated by this. So there's some other element besides just this argument that it's just kind of petty, small bureaucratic authoritarianism, which is definitely driving some of the interest. And I really do think it was BuzzFeed that had kind of a headline, editorial headline, obviously. Ahmed is the Muslim hero we've been waiting for. There has for, ever since 9/11, and especially lately in the last few years, Muslims have become just sort of the it minority that it's okay to pick on and to just say absolutely crazy things. And when you see the politicians getting away with it, you know that a lot of the culture has sort of internalized it and said it's okay to do. And, I've been writing about the issue for months and months. None of the stories really ever blew up like this one. I think when you get a kid who can essentially symbolize that, and, when you see this kid, he grew up in Sudan, but, he has no accent at all. And that matters to some people. He's very well spoken. He's clearly, a little bit dorky. He's somebody kids can relate
nerd.
To.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when they see this kid with the Joe Smith of Muslim names, but who is in every sense an American, who has been just what a lot of people take as an obvious injustice has been done to him, and they see the reason for that as this Islamophobic undercurrent that's been percolating for years and years, that's kind of the lightning spark that turned this from, kid brings a toy gun to school and gets arrested, and which is on one level, and this, which is on an entirely different magnitude in terms of reaction.
It seems, too, that, you talk to the BBC, right?
Yeah.
And when they're talking to you, is there an accusation or just an acknowledgement of the fact that America has this problem and, England doesn't?
That didn't come up in any of the questions that I've been asked. I do think that there are... it's an entire... I know that there is a lot of discrimination against Muslims in some European countries, but I think it's an entirely different case because there are huge ways of immigrants from Muslim countries coming into these traditionally Western countries, and, they're at a different socioeconomic level. They have different culture. They probably have more crime in their communities, and so... That doesn't exist in America. Our Muslim population is something 1 or 2%. When you hear arguments, stuff like the mayor has been at least abiding, if not promoting, in her speeches that Muslims are plotting to take over American courts. I mean, that's just I have to be objective, but that's crazy. And that's a uniquely American problem because we're raising this boogeyman out of a population that's one of the least powerful and populous in America. I mean, the Jews in Europe before World War II had about the same percentage of the population as the Muslims in America did now. And they were the boogeyman for decades before that happened.
whenever something like this happens in Texas, I just imagine like Arizona and Alabama, Mississippi sighing with relief. It's like, ah, Texas.
God, no. Yeah.
Just like we do when something bizarre happens in Florida or somewhere else. We're not the craziest. Awesome.
Yeah. I think the social media response is something we have to talk about. I know your story is already up to like 2.3 million views, I think the last number I saw. I love that it was Ahmed's sisters that created his first Twitter account.
That's the thing I love most is, despite being just a total tech nerd, you know, this is a kid who makes his own radios and his room looks like, you know, just littered with circuit boards and wires. He had absolutely no interest in social media. And, you know, I asked him when I first interviewed him before he became international, what are your friends, you know, saying about, are people tweeting about this going on? I don't know. I don't have any interest in social media. He didn't have an account. He had a Kick account, his sisters say, and that was it. So, and we're talking, his sisters are like 17 and 18 years old. So when the story goes out and it starts, you know, getting retweeted off the Dallas Morning News and NBC, which is a television story, Channel 8, and then this hashtag kind of crops up, which apparently there was like a UT Arlington student, I've read an article, created the hashtag I Stand With Ahmed that very quickly became viral. So the sisters decide, I think sometime over the course of that night, that he needs a Twitter account. So they make at I Stand With Ahmed, and it's there for him in the morning, and he's, you know, getting bounced around from one interview to the other, and the sister's like, what do you want to tweet out? And so when I visited them that morning, Ima and Aisha, the two sisters, were kind of simultaneously his media handlers because they were sort of controlling this account,
right,
but also just like starstruck, you know, fans, like, it's number two trend, like just the number two unpromoted trend on Twitter. Oh my God, it's just number one and I only have 100 followers. I'm like, how did all this happen? It's like, it was a beautiful little scene.
They're so jealous of him. You know they are. 18-year-old girls, like, yeah. Damn little brother has 5 million Twitter followers. You know?
It makes me wonder too, if now that this has happened, now that this story has gone so viral, it becomes so much in the national attention, if it will function as the first in many conversations we have about this happening to young people who are growing up in America, this Islamophobia. I wonder, because this seems to be how America media works, if this will be something now we'll say, oh, well, this also happened in Arizona, Florida, Mississippi,
everywhere,
or New York, everywhere. And now we'll pay a little bit more attention to it.
I think at the very least, it's going to be harder for people to make bigoted statements about Muslims, you know, in public or semi-public, and expect just no reaction. I think the social media craze will fade eventually, but I think it's going to have some lasting mark in terms of that conversation.
What happens next for Ahmed? Is he going back to school? I know there was word that he might choose not to go back to MacArthur.
Yeah, I believe he said that at a press conference late last night or yesterday evening that he's thinking about transferring, I think the quote was, to any other school. but I do know that, like, I think he's fielding multiple scholarship offers, funds, as well as, like, TAMS just offered to set him up full scholarship at a good charter school in Texas if he wants to, or maybe it was in Maryland. This is a kid who, at least right now, can take his pick of where he wants to go back to school.
Avi Selk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can keep up with Avi on Twitter, at Avi Selk, AVISELK, and read his stories at dallasnews.com. We'll also put a link to them on our show page at guidelive.com/podcast. Avi, thanks for being here.
Happy to do it.
From low-profile bazaars to just about any venue that will accommodate a ring surrounded by folding chairs, Lucha Libre carries on a long-time tradition of entertaining its devout fans in the Dallas area. Fans of all ages and diverse backgrounds cheer on masked luchadores, who might be their neighbors or teachers. They might not be the premier acrobatic athletes who fly around in wrestling rings in Mexico, but they don the colorful masks with the same goal in mind, give the adoring crowd a show. Here to tell us more is Al Dia writer Vianney Aldrete and Dallas Morning News photographer Nathan Hunsinger. Both of you, welcome to Mixed Media.
Hola.
Tonight, tell us, for those who are not familiar, other than a lot of people know the colorful costumes and the culture behind it, tell us more about Lucha Libre, the sport.
Okay, well, technically the sport is different from American wrestling in the way that it's more acrobatic. I mean, Lucha Libre translates to free wrestling. So there's a lot of flying in the air and all these different stunts, and the costumes, and everything's very colorful and a lot of energy. But that's the main difference between, let's say, WWE and Lucha Libre. Now, the difference here in Dallas is a lot. It's Lucha Libre, but an Americanized version of it. So
Tex-Mex.
Yes, like a Tex-Mex Lucha Libre. So it's a mix. You see American wrestlers and Mexican wrestlers, and the audience is mixed. And once you actually go to these places and watch Lucha Libre, the first thing that came to my mind was it was kind of like seeing old Vegas. So you see all the colors and the energy's there, but it's not quite like the MGM Grand Hotel.
Everybody's smoking.
Well, not smoking, but they're eating, like, I don't know, chicharrones or little chips with salsa in.
I could definitely see it being a hipster kind of thing down the line because it's just so odd. But fun, there's so much energy when she's saying high flying.
I can already
flying.
See the New York Times trend story on that.
Right, yeah.
So the two pop culture reference points I have, I know very little about Lucha Libre, but Santo, I know. He was kind of a legend, right?
Yes, he's, I don't even know, I guess the Elvis Presley, if we're going to go into Vegas comparisons. He had movies in the 60s, he came out in the 40s, and ever since he's probably like the number one rock star in Mexico. Well, Lucha Libre is like the second most popular sport after soccer, so that's how big it is.
He was like a horror movie star for
a
little while.
He fought mummies and female vampires. I don't know.
You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
There was a good documentary about him at the Dallas International Film Festival a couple of years ago called The Man Behind the Mask.
Mm-hmm. So wait, is your other cultural reference
here
point Jack Black?
Yes, Nacho Libre. Very good, Lauren Smart. So yeah.
Lucky guess.
And that I'm not a big fan of that movie just because the tone of the comedy isn't quite my cup of tea, but how does it represent this actual world and this sport?
Well, I didn't know until I was editing one of my editor's little summary on that movie, but that was a real story. There was a priest he was a priest during the day, and he was a wrestler, luchador, at night, and he would gather that money and give it to the church. So I guess now I actually like that movie. So it's just like a cheesy Mexican version of Lucha Libre. It has the general idea. Is it precise? I don't know about that.
And it's got Jack Black playing luchador.
So, I mean, is it an underground culture? Who's going to these events in Dallas?
I saw a mix, but mainly Hispanic. But there's a mix of wrestlers as well as the crowd. So it was kind of all across the board.
It's got to be fun to shoot, right?
Oh, challenging for sure, but fun because I don't know Spanish, so I used verbal cues. I didn't realize I did that until I was shooting this. I didn't know what was going on, and there's no predicting it. All of a sudden, somebody can come out at the back and just hit somebody with a bat or whatever, and then they get scared. They're very good actors when it comes down to it. I actually thought one guy was hurt. I thought he hurt his knee. And I went to the back. I was like, man, did someone mess up? He's like, no, that was just acting. I was like, pretty impressed with that, actually.
Wait, are you saying wrestling is not real?
I didn't want to. I didn't know we were going to.
That's the Vegas element. So, Nathan, I had a chance to join you on one of your shoots. You did some photos for this for FD Magazine in our October men's issue. And I joined you at the Gaston Bazaar in East Dallas, which I had not been to before. An amazing place, by the way. You can buy birds, handmade boots. You can get your chair upholstered. You can buy some good food.
Is it like a Botanica kind of place?
It's just everything you can think of. Dresses, clothes.
Stereo equipment.
Truly, yeah, anything. Amazing place. The wrestlers came in. By the way, we mentioned Vegas, but one of them had almost kind of a Britney Spears-esque outfit with kind of you know, no shirt, colorful, you know, armbands, flared pants, kind of bell-bottom pants, you know, the mask. I mean, the costumes are amazing, and many of them are handmade.
Yes, Sergio does a lot of the masks himself. He's kind of the leader of the whole group. And just bright, bright colors with colors that should not go together, but in this situation they do. Silver with red and gold all together, and it's gaudy, but it's a fun kind of gaudy.
And the masks are actually a nod to tradition. And maybe you can tell us more about it. You know, the masks were originally meant to evoke deities and gods or animals. There were meanings to the designs and the patterns in the mask. Or perhaps not.
No, not really. See, like this Lucha Libre in Mexico started during like the 1860s during the French intervention. And after that, I guess they mixed wrestling, like Roman wrestling with theater. So that's where the mask first came out. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe from what I've heard in Dallas, luchadores, wrestlers take like an extra step to be extra colorful. And extra
that's so Dallas.
Shiny, yeah. So that's the difference. But no mask. I guess in the beginning it was supposed to be like white is good and red is bad, like the devil. But it doesn't really take that much of an import. Like it's not that important or necessary anymore.
Well, I'm curious though. So the masks, when you see them today as sort of a piece of theater, do you get a sense of the character the wrestler is trying to create?
Oh, definitely. You have your bad guys and your good guys, and they dress accordingly. One of my favorite guys was Rage, just a big guy that had he actually didn't wear a mask. He had face paint. Just real, real dark, and he looked pure evil, and he did things just to make everybody mad, and just yelling at the crowd, just getting everybody into it. It's almost interactive. I mean, if you're there and you start yelling at the wrestler, he will literally come out and yell at you and pretend to smack you around, and I wish I knew what they were saying at the time, but it was great.
Yeah. Let's switch over for a moment to talk about the scope of this project with Aldea's Tommy Cummings and Jorge Chavez. Tommy, Jorge, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So how did this project come about? What was the genesis of this collaboration on Lucha Libre?
Well, I was filling in at Neighbors Go for one of the section editors, and I had to call the Gaston Bazaar to find some information. Well, I found out about Lucha Libre and figured it was some sort of weird thing going on. I just couldn't figure it out. Best I knew of Lucha Libre was some of the stereotypes that I had in my head. And so I called around, and sure enough, and did some searching. And Lucha Libre has a strong kind of a low-profile culture in the Dallas area.
And how did this project went? What was so amazing is this was not just a story that you guys produced, but suddenly this project grew from Aldea, the Spanish-language newspaper of the Dallas Morning News, to our Arts and Life section, to FD, our style magazine. I mean, how did you even conceive to try and do that?
Well,
and why, really, in a way? I mean, it's bold. I love it. But tell me what you were thinking.
I think it all started with the pictures. You know, once we saw the potential for a very visual project, everybody started to get interested in it. And, you know, it was such a cool idea, very, very fun. So all the departments thought that it was a fun idea, a fun project. So it was great.
Yeah, on a Neighbors Go scale, you know, we have community editions. And so most of the communities have Lucha Libre events going on, several of them do. And so, okay, we have that on a community scale. So I approached Alfredo Carbajal at the Aldea, and I said, can you help us with the reporting on this to make sure we're, you know, we're doing it appropriately? And he put Jorge on it, and with V&A's help, we were able to really drill down into the culture of Lucha Libre, and it was a lot more colorful than I was expecting. And so there is so much there's so much breadth to what we're trying to do that I thought, okay, we need to kind of probably expand this and take it upon several brands.
Cut to the pictures in our glossy fashion magazine.
Well, I went to Guide Live and I asked Ann Pinson, you know, can, you know, we'll have, I know you're a little bit more events and venue based. So we had a package of events and venues. And then I'm walking by FD one day and I see Rob, you know, working in, around there. And I said, might be a fashion spread on this. So I approached him and he got on board with it. And it just kept going. Yeah.
Well, we want to leave listeners in this case with all the places they can go see it. Because I know there's videos, there's an interactive that was put together. So where can people find all of this? And I think you have an official hashtag, very social media savvy.
Yes, Lucha Libre Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And then the interactive is on just the website, DallasNews.com? Or
yes, DallasNews.com/ Lucha Libre Dallas. We wanted to establish a brand, even through the hashtag, so that it'd be easier to find.
It's cool. And the videos, by the way, which are very fun, they're like music videos, were shot by our own mixed media producer, Brian Elledge, our engineer. Yeah.
Shout out.
Check him out.
He's not here today, though.
Yeah, sorry.
Tommy Knoll's awesome, too, though. He is here. Thank you, Viene, Nathan, Tommy, and Jorge for joining us today.
Thank you.
That is, of course, Garth Brooks, who apparently is still very much a thing, a cultural happening. He is doing shows in 6 days at AAC in Dallas, like one of the old Frank Sinatra runs at the Sands, or something like that, dating myself here. Here to join us to talk about Garth-omania and the staying power of one of country music's legends is the great Hunter Hawk, pop music critic.
Hello.
Of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Hunter.
Can I? Good to be here.
That's a nice tie.
Thank you.
You're wearing a tie today.
Yeah, you look nice.
Yeah, I have to meet Garth in like an hour.
And did he say, Hunter, you must wear a tie?
No, I just feel better because I might be in part of a video, so you got to.
I thought you better look the part.
You got to look the part.
Will you be line dancing?
I'll try not to.
Okay.
I think that would send viewers away in droves.
We appreciate that. So I was kind of amazed by all of this just because I associate Garth Brooks with a much earlier part of my life.
Right.
How do you explain his staying power and endurance? That's a lot of shows to pack in.
Well, I think the fact that he hasn't been out on the road in 17 years, there's a factor of, oh my God, will he do it again? I mean, even if I ever liked only one song, I better see it. And I've talked to a lot of people who have that attitude about it. They may only know Friends in Low Places or a couple of other songs, but they're like, I got to see this. This is seven shows in 6 days. It's got to be a crazy thing, so I want to witness it.
Have you talked to anybody who's going to all of them?
No.
Is that a thing people are doing?
Oh, I'm sure somebody is going to all
Surely,
of them.
Yeah.
There have been people going to all of them in previous cities because Garth Brooks will refer to people giving him requests every night for a song that is not in the prearranged set list. And I think he has bent to their will a couple of times and just pulled out the song they wanted because he'll see the same face or the same sign like seven times in a row.
But, so what? Help us understand, Hunter, the appeal of Garth Brooks. Like Chris, I was sort of, he was kind of forced upon all of us in the, I guess, early aughts, and then retired, kind of went away for a while, and now he's back and apparently bigger than ever. But what is the secret sauce that makes him such a breakout performer?
What's the deal with Garth Brooks?
I mean, yeah. Really, Why Garth? Why now?
I think it's the fact that he is just totally himself and his range of influences. Whether they fit together or not, he's going to force them into his repertoire. And it somehow worked in the 90s because he was big and bold and brash, and he brought a sort of an arena feel to country music that hadn't been there before. And I think, you know, he was also a student of 70s rock, which was huge for, a generation of people who like to go out to concerts. So he brought that crowd out, and he also loved 70s folk, like the soft James Taylor stuff. So he was just a student of music. He put everything in he could into his own music and sort of broke the mold and, ticked a lot of people off in the process. But, like I said in the story, for every one of those people, there are 10 more who he found and kept throughout the years.
Who did he tick off? The purists?
I think the purists. And you look at the country music today, and he sounds absolutely twangy compared to that.
I was going to say, is he responsible in any way for, say, the Luke Bryans and the bro country artists that are dominating
partially
now?
In the aspect that they play huge arenas, and you can attribute that to Kenny Chesney's of the world too. Just the bigger, ambitious shows at stadiums that go for more of a rock feel with the pyro and the smashing guitars and things like that. Garth did a lot of that.
He certainly paved the way for Shania Twain, who I think of as really benefiting from that.
Yeah.
She went so far as to have country versions, I remember, and rock and pop versions of the same song.
Which was completely unnecessary, but, you know, it helped her sell
it
probably
was kind of fun to listen
a
to,
million
but,
more.
Yeah.
I mean, country and hip-hop are like the two genres that move units consistently. Still,
totally,
right?
Totally. I think because there's a party
vibe to
it.
Taylor Swift and all this, true.
Yeah,
true.
I forgot to even mention, I think, Taylor Swift in the story, but she's probably the biggest product of Garth Brooks because, you know, there's no limits on what sounds you want to put into your body of work now, I think. And you can start with country, pull all those people in, and then just work to conquer the world after that.
Call Kendrick Lamar and see if he wants to hop on a song.
Yeah. But I think the Garth Brooks of now is appealing because he did those 3 years in Las Vegas, and he really opened himself up to the crowds there in a way that we hadn't known Garth before. He sort of told his whole story of his influences and his family life through his songs, and he played cover songs. And so I think I feel like we know him better now. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the arena show looks like and how personalized it is compared to just, you know, making a big show of it the way he used to at Reunion Arena and Texas Stadium, you know.
Where do you place him in the pantheon of, you know, the big, obviously sales-wise, he's, you know, the king, but where do you place him with the likes of, I don't know, your legends, your Johnny Cashes and Merle Haggards and, I guess, you know, more recent artists as well. Artistically, where do you place him?
It's hard to say. I think he bridges he's a bridge between those two things. For the people who are 20 and coming up in country music now, he's their Johnny Cash. He's their, you know, the person they look to. But he's very happy to bring in all of those influences from when he was growing up, too. So, in a way, he reminds people of the great parts of country music that shouldn't ever go away. I mean, he grew up on Haggard and Jones, and he's gonna probably cover George Strait at the show, or one of the shows tonight, or one of these seven. You know, so he has been covering, I think, Amarillo by Morning.
How's Merle doing these days? I heard his health wasn't the greatest.
He still tries to tour when he can.
Awesome.
If he comes back around, I'm definitely going.
He was supposed to open for the Stones 1 year when I actually saw them, and I was really looking forward to seeing him, and he was sick, so I didn't get to see Merle.
And I think a lot of people don't give him and his colleagues credit of that time, because he opened himself up to a lot of different kinds of music, and people respected him beyond the country world.
I'm a huge Merle fan.
In a way, he could have been Garth's role model in that way, too. Buck Owens as well.
I'm curious about the seven shows in the same arena in 6 days phenomena. And I'm curious, first of all, how many days do you actually think he could have sold out? I mean, how much longer could it have gone on?
I don't really know.
Forever, Lauren. Forever.
Yeah, that's, I mean.
There were two shows originally scheduled, but no one thought it would end with that. That's kind of his MO with these shows. He'll announce two, and then they'll sell out like in a minute. And then they'll just keep adding and adding until, I guess, the venue's calendar is stretched to the max.
Yeah.
He probably could have done 10 or 12, to be honest with you. But or he could have done one large show at AT&T Stadium, but thank God he didn't.
Right. Yeah, because that would have been about the same amount. I mean, you were saying earlier that maybe it would have been the same amount of tickets.
Yeah, George Strait, his last concert was at AT&T. I think it was 104,000. And I think that's the total number that Garth has sold for these seven shows. But I think it'll be a much more intimate experience, relatively, at American Airlines Center for these people. And it'll feel like you're in Garth's house as opposed to Jerry's.
It's actually kind of admirable because he's obviously not somebody who's having trouble making car payments for instance.
Not at all. I think he genuinely feels the need to connect with the fans on that level. I think that's why he came back a little bit earlier than he wanted to do the Vegas thing, but he had a lot of concessions where they would fly him out for that show and he would fly right back to hang with his daughters. But now that his daughters are grown, all bets are off and he's all over the place again. And who knows, he'll probably tour for a few years to come. It's probably not the last one. This has also given him a chance to showcase his wife, who is a brilliant performer, Trisha Yearwood. She gets like a section in the middle of his set, which is like an opening act's dream.
That's
because
awesome.
Right. You don't have to deal with the crowds who are kind of like shuffling in.
And she's really good.
Yeah, she's great.
And she has a fun cooking show. Go to Trisha.
Yes.
Does she really?
She does. I DVR it.
I was not aware.
I don't follow any of the recipes. But
Trisha hanging at home, cooking up food.
I'm getting an education here in the Mixed Media Podcast.
So, Hunter, you the third episode of your podcast, Listening, came out, and Garth is on that episode, right?
Yeah, it's sort of an abridged reading of the Sunday story I did on Garth Brooks. And then I follow that up with two much lesser-known artists, Lara Lynn, the singer from The True Detective, Season 2. Mm-hmm. I did a phone interview with her, so I included some of that.
Perhaps the only good thing to come out of Season 2 of yeah. True Detective.
The much maligned
Although
season
she and
two.
I kind of bonded on that one. I think
really? You like it?
It stayed with us in ways that we didn't expect.
Okay.
And then Lord Byron is a Dallas rapper. I sort of took some snippets of an interview with him and put in some songs of his to kind of introduce people to his style. So it's three little segments. Shorty.
Are you still recording them in your closet sometimes?
Yes.
On your iPhone?
Oh,
I
yeah.
Love that.
It's the best part.
Yeah. Lo-fi.
And you're doing, are you in every week or every other week now?
This one I took a little bit more time, but theoretically it's every other week.
When it's ready, he does it.
When
he
I'm ready.
Hot and fresh.
Think of me as the Kanye of podcasting.
I'll put this out when I want to. Go away. Little cut there, and then... You can keep up with Hunter's coverage of Gartharama this week via Twitter at House of Hunter. That's H-A-U-S of Hunter. Also listen to his segment on Garth Brooks on his new podcast, listening at guidelive.com/podcasthunter. Thanks for joining us. Please say hello to Garth.
I will.
For us, give him
hey Garth
our best, and we'll be right back.
Always a pleasure.
It's time to move on to our touts. This is the portion of our show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, smelling, tasting, doing other things with, or just plain obsessed with. We are going to start with Lauren Smart.
I'm going to tout an art show at the Modern in Fort Worth. They're doing a mid-career retrospective for Kinde Wiley. And he's a really incredible painter who does these large-scale portraitures that are they're portraits that are made in the style of like 18th century, 19th century portraits. But he has redone them, and there's he's focused on the African American male and urban fashion, and they're really beautiful. They're just gorgeous, gorgeous portraits. So I'm gonna tout the Modern's Kinde Wiley show.
I'm gonna
Amazing.
I'm going to try to be all McLaughlin report here. Hunter Hawk!
What was that? Oh,
well, I will be at the Modern this Sunday to see that. So
oh, yeah, good.
I'm excited. But my tout, I have two touts.
That was a maybe, double tout.
So double tout.
Oh, okay.
Presumptuous. Uh-huh. First of all,
make
there's...
make yourself at home. Like
right. Yeah. Obion Threes is an Austin rock band. They just put out their fourth album. It's called Worth a Lot of Money. And it's just
good
one
title.
Of those. Yeah, they're compared to Thin Lizzy a lot, but it's just kind of feel good rock and roll, the kind of thing you would put in your car and just drive fast. I like it a lot. And the other thing is, you're going to laugh, but it kind of goes back to that Song of Summer segment we did.
Mm-hmm. Please tell me it's Justin Bieber.
I love that song.
Thank you.
I was kind of wanting to jump in a time machine and defend you
in
that last show.
Yeah.
But no, this is Ryan Adams. This is Ryan Adams' cover of Taylor Swift's Bad Blood, which just premiered online, and it's a very tasteful version, but it's nice. I mean, it
I actually
that,
played that. I liked it.
Yeah.
I was intrigued.
His album-length cover of 1989 is coming out Monday, so
oh,
I thought that
cool.
was timely.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Christopher Wynn.
I have my real tout is this Saturday. I'm going to the Design Walk down the Design District.
I'll be there too.
It'll be nice
See
weather.
You there.
So it's Saturday night, 5 to 9.
Be there.
All the galleries, restaurants, showrooms will be open. My first date is at the James McEnroe showroom, which I love, and they're going to have lots of fuzzy, bubbly stuff to drink. And then my fake touts, because we haven't talked about them yet on this episode, is Wild Detectives Bookstore, no reason, and HBO's The Wire.
Which are the Wire?
Which are the two things that come up every other... Yeah.
They did today, though.
2002 called. It wants its tout back.
That's why I have to force them in. For some reason, they always... Actually, I guess you missed it, Chris, but for some reason, those kept coming up even while you were gone.
No, but last week, we didn't talk about The Wire, and I think it's because... Chris, you weren't here.
I know. I gotta. I'm glad somebody else is picking up the Wire mantle for me, though.
It all comes back down to the Wire.
Show me a hero, though.
Yeah, that's awesome. Oh. Yeah, The Wire is merely the greatest television show ever.
So if that's important to you, then yes. FYI.
If you're into those kinds of things, so I'm actually touting a movie. How about that? Since I watch a lot of movies and stuff. It's a really good movie. It comes out next week, and it's called Sicario. It's actually one of the best films I've seen this year. It's set on the border, actually the border between Texas and Mexico and also Arizona and Mexico. It's a drug cartel thriller. Three fantastic performances by Emily Blunt.
I love her.
And Benicio del Toro.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, also very good.
And Josh Brolin. And it's just a very, man, Brolin's.
Can we just read names all day long? I'll let you do that.
Almost had a three for there.
Brolin's
almost.
Got game, I'm telling you. Brolin's doing really well right now.
Just be glad Matt Damon's not in it.
Yeah.
It's a very taut, tight, lean, psychological thriller about sort of the hazy moral lines that go into this war on drugs. And Benicio del Toro's character is one of my favorite ambiguous bad guys that I've seen in a really long time. And it was shot by the great Roger Deakins, who I believe has been nominated for 12 Oscars for cinematography and has not won yet. So I'm
the Susan Lucci of cinematography.
Exactly.
You stole my joke.
I am hoping. I think it's
going to be fast.
I don't think either of you created that, actually. but it's a great movie.
I should diss us both on that
one. One of the best of the year. It is called Sicario. Which actually it means hitman in Mexican culture.
Where can we see it in Dallas? Do we know?
I'm pretty sure. It will definitely be in more than one theater. It will be at either the Angelica or the Magnolia, and I think it's big enough that it will also show elsewhere. I think it opens in New York and L.A. this Friday, actually. So if you're in New York and L.A., go see it before then.
And thanks for listening to us.
Absolutely. We love both of your cities.
Forget the design walk.
Yeah. Very much. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com, the entertainment website of the Dallas Morning News. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at mixedmediapod. You can now subscribe to our show in iTunes. Just search for our name, Mixed Media. Today's Mixed Media was engineered by the great Tommy Knoll and produced by Christopher Wynn. Go Tommy.
Yay!
We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn, Hunter Hawk, Lawrence Smart, and me, Chris Wagner, we thank you for joining us.